CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Supported and empowered by the students of SFU and listeners like you. For your community, by your community. You are CJSF.
White E beat snack seal.
Tan She.
Tanek E. Negad Dakote.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Kwe, hello. My name is Pam Palmiter, and I'm your host for the Mi'kmaq episodes of Words and Culture. I'm a member of Ugbaganjig, otherwise known as Eel River Bar First Nation, and that's part of the larger Mi'kmaq Nation. Let me ask you a question. Have you ever heard someone say that Indigenous languages were oral and not written? For decades, anthropologists have even argued that written language was the mark of a complex and advanced society. Ugh, can you hear the colonialism and racism in that argument? Well, unsurprising to us, new science shows that writing was not present in all complex societies, but that those societies were complex nonetheless. For Mi'kmaq people, we had both an oral language and a written one. And to talk about the written form of the Mi'kmaq language is my friend Michelle Sillaboy from Wagoma. Michelle is an award-winning interdisciplinary artist whose work features the written part of our language. She even has it on clothing. I wanted to have her on this show because she is so passionate about sharing and protecting and promoting everything about our Mi'kmaq language, oral and written. I also asked Michelle to introduce herself.
Nindawisi Michelle Sillaboy, aha wedabeksi, wego ama unamari, wajigwayaba, gizigwani miga, grand chief Ben Sillaboy, or aha David Emo Marie, aha the wajisquijanuyaba, wajisquijanuid miga, that was ignorant, Clarence Patlaso, aha, nadawanik lea weedma, aha, ninkijo narej. Alexandrine Sillaboy, we go amara, leo ipma. Dwaisha, eh, na de wadabixi. My name is Michelle Sillaboy, and I'm originally from Wego Amara, Cape Breton. I was raised by the late Grand Chief Ben Sillaboy and his wife Marie. My parents that brought me into this world are the late Clarence Patlis from Nadawanik, New Brunswick, formerly known as Eel Ground. And my mother was Alexandrine Sillaboy from Wego Ama, Cape Breton. So yeah, that's my genealogy, I guess, or my background and where I'm from.
I admire all of the ways in which you promote and preserve the Mi'kmaq language. I'm hoping you can tell the difference between the words Mi'kmaq and Ilnu. Like some Mi'kmaq introduce themselves as, hi, I'm a Mi'kmaq person, and other people say, hi, I'm, you know, Ilnu. What's the difference? Or is it the same thing?
They're the same now, but from what I understand, you know, when the settlers arrived, I think they misinterpreted our ancestor when, you know, when they asked them, who's, where are you and who's here? And I think that this, our ancestor most likely told them, you know, my family's over there. You know, and he anglicized it, I guess, to Mi'kmaq at the time. And so we were stuck with Mi'kmaq. But when you're speaking our, you know, our language, and when elders ask you, you know, Olnuisinet, you know, and you say, yeah, I speak our language. I've never been asked Mi'kmaqisin, you know, like, and because we, not once in my entire life have I ever been asked that. So Olnuisin is like, do you speak our language? Because we are the people, and Olnuk are the people. And that's basically who we are, the people. The narrative on us has been kind of to me anyway. Everybody will have their interpretation, and I know not everybody's going to agree with me, but I think that we need to exercise our right to reclaim our historical narrative as who we are as the people, because if you speak French, you're French. If you speak English, you're English. If you speak if you're Italy, you speak Italian. And we're all new, all new is Uti. So, and that's something that I think we need to look at as a nation, you know, revitalize who we are as a people, which we are Olnuk. And Olnuk is Uti, and we speak the Olnuk language. So, you know, we've kind of come to that place of saying Mi'kmaq. Our language is verb-based, so we describe everything. So since we're a verb-based language, I'm describing from my perspective what I think these words mean to us as Olnuk.
When I was in university, I took two different language courses. One was Verwulistikwe. They were calling it Maliseet at the time, and Mi'kmaq. And the elder who was teaching the Mi'kmaq language explained everything like you did. And she also said, and you know, we have a word for family that's Nigama, like with the N at the front. And she said, that's very, very close. So there's probably a lot of misinterpretations on contact about what different words meant. And so she was like, ultimately, we're the people. And it's about our family. And she always had, just like you, this the most positive, beautiful way of explaining our language. And I'm still on my Mi'kmaq language learning journey, still basically at baby steps, because I took that language course, studied really hard, and then moved away. And then it was like, you know how quickly you can lose language if it's not your first language. So I'm really appreciating everything that you're sharing. Like, one of the things that I rely on now is the Mi'kmaq online dictionary that they have. I find it's really useful. It's individual words as opposed to concepts or sentences, though sometimes they say a word in a sentence. But I find they don't have everything. Like one of the words that I couldn't really find a good explanation for, or a combination of words or phrases, is a word that signifies two-spirit. Because you've identified as two-spirit, and you have been an advocate celebrating Pride Week. And I always wondered, okay, how would Mi'kmaq people or Olnu say two-spirit in a way that makes sense in our culture? Can you help us with that?
We don't say two-spirit, for one. That's a translation from the Ojibwe people to English from their own language, and that's how they describe their queer people. From what I understand, and I thought it was the best interpretation, because many of our two-spirit people are gifted, and they have the ability to walk between worlds. And many of our two-spirit people have the ability to do many things that support our families and communities. And at one point, they would have been the medicine people of the communities. And so there's a word that we say buon, and buon is the shaman, the medicine person. That's what I'm wearing now. I carved it into this moose bone, so medicine in the hieroglyphics, so medicine woman. I thought, you know, it was important to reclaim We are, because we all, you know, and when you say woe, it can be, doesn't necessarily have a, I guess, a sexual preference. You can be straight and be a woe, and you can be queer as a woe. And the only difference between the two is that those who were actually, who were born two-spirited were born with the gifts. They were naturally born with gifts. And so we didn't necessarily have to go through ceremony the way heterosexual people do when they're trying to go through their teachings and knowledge and, you know, look at the world in the way they decided to look at the world, which is through spirit and through culture and through ceremony. One of my cousins said that he was told by his elders that we were Bwoan. The closest thing that we can call ourselves is a Bwoan. So that, I think, is something that I understood as the most reasonable explanation because of who I am and what I bring into this world as an artist, as a you know, as an educator, and the gifts that I was naturally born with, which I, you know, will use to when it's needed. I don't, you know, I don't always use the gifts that I was born with unless it's needed. So,
well, thank you so much for sharing that, because it's important. I think there's so many Indigenous words that get used as if it's a word that applies to all different First Nations or Inuit or Métis, for example. Some of our allies will just say Miigwech for everything, as if there's only like one Indigenous language or one word that signifies that. So that's really important to make those clarifications, that we have our own. It's not just the words, it's the concepts and the meanings behind them. They're not all the same. As an academic myself, I am always interested in what my fellow Innu are studying or researching, publishing or working on. And I know you're working on your PhD dissertation, and you're kind of in the final stages at, I think it's Simon Fraser University, but it incorporates a very special form of the Mi'kmaq language. And I'm hoping you can share that with us, because it's a form of our language that not everybody would readily think of as, oh, here's Mi'kmaq language.
Yeah, yes. I'm doing my dissertation on our Gomqhajewiigasigul written language, and Gomqhajewiigasigul is translated in English, it means suckerfish writing. And the late Merdina Marshall, when she wrote her book about the history of the Gomqhajewiigasigul, she was told by her elders that the way we describe it is suckerfish writing, because we're a descriptive language group. You know, I guess at one point an elder said it looks like the markings of what a suckerfish leaves in the sand. Gomqhajewiigasigul is broken up into two words. Gomqhwech is a suckerfish. Wiigasigul is writing. So suckerfish writing. So that's the translation for the hieroglyphic language. When I decided to do my my PhD, I wanted it to be around the language. And from a very young age, I was fascinated by our written language. Since way back in, you know, in the 80s, when I was living in Toronto, I was hanging out with the Simon family. And one of my dearest friends, she's my friend to this day, Bernadette Simon, came home with this article, and they were comparing our language, our hieroglyphic language, to the Egyptian language, and it fascinated us. And we were kind of we had many discussions, and it kind of stuck with me. And that was back in 1988, 89, and from that conversation I started to do research, and I was, you know, 20, and I started to silk screen the symbols onto T-shirts, and I became a vendor. And that was my first artistic entrepreneurship, was to promote our language in the streets of Toronto. And because I grew up seeing the language on our on my parents' walls, they had a scroll of the Lord's Prayer, and it was only in our language. And I would see my elders read from their tattered books, you know, prayer books. So I know they existed, but what I didn't understand was why I didn't know how to read it. And so I kept it in the back of my brain, as to, because I wasn't ready and I didn't know what I was going to do. And I remember during my coursework in my graduate, you know, when I started my PhD, I wrote a paper, and it was about Namultas. Namultas is an active dialogue. And Namultas is basically a word that we say to people, which, because we don't have a word for goodbye, we say Namultas. And Namultas just means see you later, whether in person or in spirit. You know, I was thinking about all the years that I was looking at the language, and I kept saying to the language, Namultas, you know. So every 5 years I would bring it out, look at it, and, you know, think about, you know, why do you keep coming back into my life? Why are you haunting me, you know? After I finished my master's degree, I was like, well, now that I've done my master's, I should think about doing my PhD, but what am I going to do it on? And then I thought, well, this has been haunting me for over 20 years. So I thought, I'm going to, you know, look at it as an artist. And I'm going to look at it as a poet, because I'm not a linguist, you know. I'm an artist, and I thought, how do I, what can I do to make this language meaningful and also promote it in a way that people might be intrigued and plant seeds? And so I started to do lots of programming in communities. I would do workshops. I wrote the first book of poetry in our language. I collaborated with musicians all over Canada, and I would, you know, read from my book, and I would draw the hieroglyphics live so that the audience can see it. I had the audience draw it. Every time I did something to collaborate and celebrate the language, I always invited other artists to be part of that. So, yeah, it's been an interesting journey promoting our language. You know, I ended up having put together a clothing line. All the artwork that I do is now on a clothing line. The whale bones that I carved, I collaborated with community. Anybody that came into my studio, and I went to people's homes and showed them the dictionary, and I asked them one question: if you could tell the whale anything, what would you say? And could you choose a message for the whale from this dictionary? And with your permission, can I carve it into the whalebone? And almost everybody said yes. So, and that exhibition toured, went from Newfoundland to Alberta, and it spent a year at the Art Gallery of Nova Scotia. So it's had a lot of exposure, and I'm hoping that I could find a permanent home for it so that more people can learn about our language, because not everybody knows that we had a written language. They just assume that we didn't. And there's a lot of assumptions around our history, and I think that that needs to be changed, because, and I say assumptions because we have a very old language. The petroglyphs that are located in Bedford and Kejimkujik, and you know, the Bedford one is pre-contact, so it's been there. We don't know how long it's been there, but it's definitely pre-contact. And the petroglyphs in Kejimkujik tell the story of contact. So to me, because they tell stories and people know what these stories are, that's our language. So I really want us to reclaim what they are, which is our Gomhajiwigasigul, and our leaders in the past used it to record history. And it was originally used as a guide for hunters. So not only did our leaders use it to record history and what was going on, but the hunters used it to guide those to go pick up the moose or the deer or whatever. So it was used as maps. And so our language came from the land. It's from the land. And that, to me, is an important connection to say, is that the Mi'kmaq language comes from the land.
I love that, how our language is from the land and it's verb-based and it's storytelling and it's our history and our future. I just love all of that. Another part of your art and creativity and language preservation is your clothing line. And I noticed that it's called We Talk. What's the Mi'kmaq word for your We Talk design? And what is your design all about?
You know, I asked on my social media platform, because I like to involve people. I said, I need a brand name for my clothing line. And I had my settler friend said, We Talk. Your language talks. I'm like, and then my elder separately said the same thing. She said, Agnudaman. And they both mean the same thing. So, and that's why it's called We Talk Agnudaman. So they mean the same thing. So it's like, the language talk, the clothes talks.
I love it. And it's called wearable art, but it's also got some of the hieroglyphics on it.
One of the favorites is Walalioch, which is We Thank You. And that particular image was taken during the time my father was in the hospital before he moved on to the spirit world. And I was just walking around in my village down by the river, and this puddle was, I love taking macro photography. So I tend to take images of things that people have to wonder what that is. And that particular image was in the shape of the symbol for We Thank You, Walalio. And I thought, what a wonderful way to acknowledge Mother Earth. And then another design I listened to us, which is Jigsidunin. I wanted to look at how we as Indigenous people have been perceived by governments in power, and we're often never listened to. And I thought, you know, this is the statement of, you know, wanting to be at the table, wanting to be heard. And it's a statement that I think it's important to say out loud, and in this case, silently but loud, which the symbol is, listen to us. And it has multiple meanings, you know, because, you know, even the earth is telling us to listen to Mother Earth when there's earthquakes, there's climate change, there's all kinds of, you know, actions that Mother Nature does, and it's forcing us to listen to her. And so not only is it a statement for, you know, governments, but it's also a statement from the natural world that we're here to look after. So many of the images on my in my clothing line are, you know, they're political statements, but at the same time, important messaging. So
how would you say "listen to us" in Mi'kmaq?
Chiksiduinen. So "listen to us" is Chiksiduinen. And then because people are listening to this podcast, Jiksiduik or Jiksiduksi means they're listening. The people in Radioland, Jiksiduksi, Edloistu, they're listening to us talking. And so, but that's what's happening right now in this very moment.
Is it ever too late to learn the Mi'kmaq language?
No, it's never too late to learn the Mi'kmaq language. I think I'm very lucky, you know. I'm not really sure why I still speak it, but I think maybe because I spent 27 years in Vancouver. But because my dad was the Grand Chief, I would go home in the summertime and spend all my time with elders. And my family, immediate family, were fluent speakers. My parents were fluent speakers. And all the elders and my aunts and uncles, they were all, and my cousins, we were all fluent speakers. So we grew up in total immersion. But I also made extra effort to hang out with, spend time with my elders. And it's really important to try and do complete total immersion.
Michelle Sillaboy is an artist and academic who lives in Mi'kma'ki. She grew up immersed in the Mi'kmaq language and is passionate about passing it on to future generations. I learned so much about the Mi'kmaq language. It takes a variety of forms, written and oral. I learned that it's verb-based, it's all about action, and all of our stories are wrapped up in it. So it's like having a living language that's also connected to the land. And I've seen our petroglyphs, and they instantly connected me to the ancestors and reminded me of why I do the work that I do and why all of our people are so passionate about ensuring that our languages don't go extinct. In fact, next time I'm back home, I'm going to go see those petroglyphs again and think about everything I learned from Michelle. I'm Pam Pometer, Namultis.
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Housing down King Sam.
Namultis.
Ninuis ahaha mi ku kwa kwal.
Kachu nautano.
Wapamatin mi na.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. If you want to learn how to talk to people about climate change, one expert suggests studying Taylor Swift.
I think storytelling is the essential skill that we have to teach people who want to be better communicators in this space, and she's the master storyteller of the modern era.
Joseph Rome is a senior research fellow at the Center for Science, Sustainability, and Media at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's a Swiftie, who co-hosts a podcast in which he and his daughter analyze the storytelling techniques Taylor Swift uses in her songs. He suggests using stories to communicate about climate change because they're memorable and they engage people on an emotional level.
Start with your personal story and let people know what you've been through and why it means something to you.
And he recommends using metaphors to make concepts more relatable, like describing climate warming pollution as a heat-trapping blanket.
I think metaphors are the single most powerful thing. And of course, you know, Taylor Swift uses a great many metaphors. You know, when she says, "Darling, I'm a nightmare dressed like a daydream," right? That's two metaphors.
So to help increase awareness of climate change, Rome advises people to put on their headphones and learn from a modern master of storytelling. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You can deny all the things I've seen, all the things I've discovered, but not for much longer. because too many others know what's happening out there.
I want to believe.
Hi, this is David Duchovny, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby.